I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews, and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how the American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing the legacy that bin Laden has left behind for the United States 20 years after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. Joining us to do that is scholar James M. Dorsey, author of The Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer, now a blog and a podcast, as well as an excellent book. Dorsey is an award-winning journalist, as well as a senior fellow at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University. This conversation was recorded on September 10th, 2021, and the basis for our conversation is Dorsey's article entitled Bin Laden's Legacy Probably Surpasses His Wildest Dreams. With all that being said, let's get right to the conversation with James M. Dorsey. Welcome to Parallax Views. James M. Dorsey, author of the book and blog, The Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer. How are you doing? Well, my time is today, but it's nighttime there in Singapore where you're based.
Indeed, we're 12 hours apart. In other words, my day is almost over. Not quite, but almost over.
So I wanted to have you on to talk a little bit about Afghanistan. But first, I saw you had a new piece out entitled Bin Laden's Legacy Probably Surpasses His Wildest Dreams. And I like how you started out. It's a very jarring way to start an article. You say, at the very outset of the 21st century, Osama bin Laden wittingly or unwittingly positioned himself with the 9/11 attacks as one of its most important figures. For people that may find that statement, you know, I don't know how many would actually find it surprising. I think it's common sense. But what did you sort of mean by that? Well, why is he so important in the 21st century?
Let me start off by linking this in a sense to Afghanistan. So the Afghanistan war or the invasion of Afghanistan would not have happened without 9/11. I don't know that that's true for the Iraq war. So you had a school of thinking in the United States, and particularly in Washington, since the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, that essentially one felt that Iraq was the key, almost in a domino process, a falling domino process, was the key to democratization in the Middle East, and that, in a sense, the United States should have long done in the Middle East what it did in Europe in 1945 and in the Second World War. So you can question whether everything that we are now attributing to as a fallout of the 9/11, some of that was not already there, which I think in the case of Afghanistan was not. However, perhaps the most fundamental paradigm shift that we have seen in the two decades since 9/11, and that's not in the stratosphere of, you know, simply of foreign policy, the blob, or whatever you want to call it, but it affects us all. And that is the cohesiveness of Western society, not only of Western societies, but of certainly of actually of societies at large. So you see the rise of populism, and there are multiple reasons for populism that go beyond 9/11, but 9/11 was a major factor in that. One of the things it did was it destroyed the notion of multiculturalism in Europe, which was basically a continent coming to grips with the fact that they historically were not immigrant societies, but they had become immigrant societies for a variety of reasons. You see it in the United States, the polarization, white supremacist thinking, Islamophobia. I mean, you know, basically racism of whatever form, whether it's Islamophobic, whether it's against people of color, whether it's anti-Semitic, has, in a sense, is no longer taboo socially. It's become mainstream. And that, I think, is a product of 9/11 and a fundamental, you know, shift that not many people achieve in their lives, but Bin Laden has, whether we like it or not.
So in that regard, what do you think the biggest legacy of 9/11 is, just beyond that sort of destruction of the multicultural paradigm? I mean, I think a lot of what you're talking about is the sort of reintroduction or resurgence of a sort of identity politics.
Yes. Let me put it this way. What we today define as identity politics, I don't think that identities are mutually exclusive. So first of all, you know, we've moved over time from the days, certainly when I was younger, where you really were expected to have one identity. You were American, you were German, you were Indian, you were Japanese, you were whatever it may be. Today, I mean, look at how Americans identify themselves. They're Americans, maybe, are the ones that give you, on first encounter, the most detailed ethnic definition of themselves. So it's not even just I'm Indian American or I'm Japanese American. I'm one part this and one part that, and there's another part of this and another part of that. And so you get quarters or eighth or whatever it may be. So as a matter of principle, when we're talking today about identity politics, we're really talking about exclusionary politics rather than identity in the sense that, you know, we all have multiple identities, you know, and those identities are ethnic, they're national, they're ethnic, they're religious, they're whatever sports club you may be supporting, and so on. So there are a multitude of things, and yet you can incorporate that in one person, and so can any, and so can communities, and interact with one another. With other words, what I'm saying is the identity politics that you're as you are referring to them, are really the outcome of what I am describing in terms of bin Laden's legacy.
And is there anything else you would add in regards to bin Laden's legacy? I think it was interesting. You note that it's almost as if bin Laden anticipated Biden's sort of stumbling later on. Could you explain that?
Well, what I based that on was a letter that he wrote to his own people in 2010. And it was in advance of a potential visit to Afghanistan by Barack Obama. And he entertained the thought of trying to assassinate Obama. But what he very explicitly said was, we target Obama. We do not target Biden, the vice president at the time. In fact, we want Obama dead, because then he will be succeeded by Biden. And Biden's going to create a mess, and that's the mess we're looking for.
I think the really important point to that specific article, too, is that in a way, the whole of the war on terror has done more to really damage democracy. I mean, if, there was always that line that I heard growing up, they hate us for our freedoms, but I feel like we've lost a lot more freedoms because of the war on terror. I mean, now we have these torture programs overseas. We have this resurgent white nationalism. It seems like our democracy has been negatively impacted from these forever wars.
Well, I think there's several elements here. First of all, I think you've got to ask your question, the question of whether the backlash, white supremacism, Hindutva in India, and so forth, whether that may not have happened anyways, but was, in any case, was accelerated, facilitated by 9/11. I also think that you got to take a step back. I, for example, don't use the word terrorism. And I use the word political violence. That's not because I in any ways endorse it, but because this is more about than a criminal act. And if what has happened is that it's been reduced to a criminal act, which enables the securitization, the militarization of efforts to counter it. The second thing to keep in mind is that political violence is a factotum of history of human beings. It's always been there. It always will be there. So the notion that you can wage war on terrorism is simply nonsensical.
It's kind of like fighting a phantom. Does, go on, I'm yeah, sorry.
If I may, what it does, it takes, by reducing it to that, it takes away looking at what really are root causes. And root causes have a lot to do with social social conditions, economic conditions. They also have to do with political conditions, repression. And if you go back to the immediate period post 9/11, first of all, we looked at Bush very differently than we do today. Bush would be great if you look back at Trump. But Bush said something, as did Condoleezza Rice, which was very fundamental. And he got it right in a way that others had not in the past. He just bumbled it in terms of how he acted on it. And that was, and I'm paraphrasing here, but fundamentally, that the United States was partly responsible for 9/11 because it had supported autocratic regimes, repressive regimes, rather than wholeheartedly supported human rights, democratization, what have you. Now, you can argue with the problem with that statement is that democracy has to come out of societies themselves. You can't export it that way. But there are all kinds of things that you can do. And so if the political violence that Bin Laden represented in terms of targeting the United States by turning this into a war on terror, rather than addressing the root causes, in some ways you made things worse. Now, granted, counterterrorism has worked. There has not been a major attack in the United States since 2001. What we saw in Europe not in 2003, 2004, but certainly in 2015, 2016, 2017, and later, Islamic State attacks were largely local operators. And since 2017, we haven't seen a major organized, we've seen a guy with a knife. We haven't seen any explosives since. So counterterrorism in that sense has worked. It's worked in the sense that it's moved it away from states that have those kind of counterterrorism capabilities to the Sahel in Africa, to southern Philippines, to Afghanistan, sort of, the lands out there.
So I want to move on to talking a little bit more about Afghanistan. But first, you end that article that we've been talking about by saying, Bin Laden may have had the last laugh. I think you say particularly that Mr. Bin Laden must have a grin on his face as the scene unfolds in Europe. Maybe you could elaborate on that just a little bit more, and then we'll move on to Afghanistan.
So what I meant with that is he has created havoc, in a sense, in Western societies that are still struggling to deal with it. I mean, look at the Hungaries, the Slovenias of this world, the Polands of this world. Look at what's happened in France in terms of regulations, or in Austria, in terms of regulations being imposed on the Muslim community that really go far. It's empowered autocracies and autocratic leaders like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who are willing to fundamentally encourage Islamophobia if it serves their purpose. Now, there's going to be a point where the West comes to grip with all of this. It's going to take time. But in the meantime, if I were Bin Laden, whether I'm above or, whether I'm looking down or looking up, I'd have a grin on my face.
Also, since you mentioned root causes, I have a lot of listeners because I live near, I'm in a college town, and a lot of my younger listeners maybe unfamiliar. What are the root causes that you were talking about earlier?
Look, they're multiple. And they can range from basically having no prospects economically. They can range from lack of social mobility to being well off, having succeeded, being a professional, yet living, being part of a community in many ways has been marginalized. There is no one single cause. There are multiple causes, and in some cases, one of those causes will be more prevalent than others. In others, another cause will be more prevalent than others. I mean, I think that you saw among the those that joined the Islamic State, particularly the younger ones. I mean, some of these people were, didn't know a lot about religion, didn't know a lot about Islam, and it was the glamour of the fight. You know, several years ago, you had a lone wolf attack the parliament in Ottawa, in Canada. And about that same time, you had a young man who was still in school who shot up the school and killed people, killed his peers. The young kid was someone, the girl he felt he was in love with wasn't responding. And he obviously reacted to that very violently. And I'm sure that there were more reasons for that and had his problems been recognized earlier, some of them had been expressed on Facebook, then maybe that had been avoidable. The guy who attacked the mosque in the parliament in Ottawa was someone who, I think he was a convert, but don't hold me to that. But he was someone who had been expelled from his mosque because of his radical thinking and his behavior. He had ended up in a homeless shelter. Someone who knew him had tried to alert the authorities. The authorities didn't respond. And so the question that I raised in an article that I wrote was, what's the difference between these two people fundamentally? What is the difference between this kid who shoots up people for personal reasons and this other person who clearly has problems, whether they're mental problems or whatever, but he clearly needs help. He actually cries out for help in his own way, doesn't get the answer, and then goes up and shoots, declares allegiance to the Islamic State and shoots up the parliament. I don't know that there's a fundamental difference between the two. And if there isn't, then that raises serious policy questions.
Now, in terms of Afghanistan itself, that's the original reason I wanted to have you on. You've been writing a lot about it, and I think a lot of people, at least here in the U.S., it's frustrating sometimes because I feel as if, you know, we've been in Afghanistan for almost 20 years and we've left. And, you know, for all that 20 years there, I don't think that people are any more, knowledgeable about Afghanistan or about, you know, just the Middle East. I don't think people really understand the differences between the Islamic State and the Taliban. And I don't think they really understand what this means that the Taliban has taken over. So maybe we can start with that. What does the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan pretend for Afghanistan and then maybe regionally?
Okay, well, first of all, obviously, it's a defeat for the United States. You know, you basically have a group, an insurgency defeating the United States. They went in to take out the Taliban and they left with the Taliban in power. There's no other way of looking at it. What it means for Afghanistan, you've got to ask yourself, what did the United States achieve? And of course, they did it. There are achievements. A part of the education became much broader. But there are clear differences in terms of advances that were made, women's rights and what have you, in major urban centers, particularly Kabul, and the rural areas of the country. And we don't really have an insight into that. So in that sense, we don't have a clear picture, at least I don't have a clear picture of what was achieved and what was not achieved. More importantly, so what you now have is what I would call, well, there's a scholar by the name of Ahmet Kuru, who's a historian. He's of Turkish origin at a university in California, who basically argues that what has set the Muslim world back for more than 1,000 years has been an alliance between the clergy and the state. That the days when you had Islam's golden age, so when they invented algebra and all this other stuff, that was when the clergy and the merchants were relatively independent. And in fact, the clergy often were merchants, or they were funded by the merchants. And so what Afghanistan today does is it is Afghanistan's return to a country run by the state, by the alliance between the state and the clergy. And that doesn't bode well. On top of which, you know, there's the whole discussion of whether we're dealing with the Taliban 2.0 or not. What it means for the neighboring states, I think the jury is out. Iran, to some degree, already has drawn a conclusion. So, with other words, the Iranians initially were willing to do business. They were trying to encourage the Taliban. Inclusivity was very important to them, because 20% of the Afghan population are Shiites, with every reason to fear the Taliban. And you look at the government that they formed, there's not a single Shiite in it. So one of the concerns that I think neighboring countries have is migration. I think we've got to be careful, but in drawing the conclusion from the scenes that we saw and the numbers that we saw at Kabul airport during the American evacuation, to draw the conclusion that everybody and his mother in Afghanistan wants to leave. We don't know that for a fact. A segment of society, and that's a segment of society that benefited most, not simply economically, and maybe not even exclusively economically, or at all economically, but benefited in greater rights. So women in Kabul, or feel that they are in danger because of their association with the Allied forces in Afghanistan over the year. But, you know, that's probably not a large percentage of the population.
Would that, not to interrupt you, but would that percentage of the population, would they skew probably more on the urban side? Is there sort of an urban-rural divide?
Absolutely. But all I'm saying is, you know, so there is the threat of migration. There's the issue of militants, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, Uyghurs, Uzbeks, Tajiks, whatever, who have a presence in Afghanistan, and who, many of which, have close associations with the Taliban. And there's obviously the fear that that could lead to cross-border attacks. Now, I think that there's a double-edged sword here. So it doesn't matter who you talk to in the international community. It doesn't matter what differences they have. China, Russia, other neighboring states, Iran, the United States, all have an interest in ensuring that Afghanistan does not become a launching pad for attacks. But if you look very carefully what has been said in discussing the responsibility of the Taliban as they take over government, in terms of ensuring that that does not happen, nobody has explicitly demanded that any of these people be handed over or extradited. The Chinese have hinted at it, and they have a history of wanting Uyghurs extradited, whether or not they are militants. So I suspect that they ultimately will. But nobody has done that as a matter of principle. And I think the reason for it is that nobody wants to say this on the record. But if you can get the Taliban to police and these groups and ensure that they are not operating outside of Afghanistan, that's a better deal than a Taliban government that basically, in response to pressure, allows these people to leave the country and you lose sight of them. So I think but the jury is out on, first of all, we don't even know if the Taliban leadership in Kabul controls the Taliban across the country. We don't know how parts of the rank and file of the Taliban would respond if indeed it turns out that the Taliban are serious, although I have my doubts about that, are serious about some of the compromising language and pledges that they have made.
I don't want to interrupt you, but what I just wanted to add to that, a lot of the analysis I'm seeing right now, particularly from places like Foreign Policy, the CFR journal, is that there may even be a real divide among the Taliban leadership versus its rank and file. I think that's sort of what you may be alluding to there.
Well, I think there's no doubt about it. And there may even be divisions within the leadership itself. Basically what you're seeing, the leadership has essentially admitted this. When the leadership, for example, said, as they entered Kabul in the days after that, they advised women to stay at home because they needed to train their men, their troops, to understand the fact that women would be in public. That already tells you that there is a gap between, it doesn't tell you that there may be differences, but it tells in terms of opposition, but it tells you that to some degree, what the leadership is saying, whether they are serious about their saying or not at this point, left aside, is very different from what their rank and file believe.
And the other,
they've already told you that. We're seeing that in terms of a lot of the reporting that you're seeing, beating up of journalists, women being asked not to return to their jobs in various places, reports of killings of Shiites, and so on. So we're already seeing that. And the question is that just simply, a lack of control? Or is that the beginnings of an internal problem?
I guess one of the big fears I have is, could we eventually see a situation where Afghanistan is headed towards a really bloody civil war?
It's possible. It's definitely possible. For one, I think that what you're going to see, you have the most two important militant groups on Afghan soil are clearly the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. There are others who more focused. You know, the Uyghurs are focused. Sure, they went to Syria, but they went to Syria because they needed, wanted the skills to be able to go back to China and fight their battles. And I think that's largely true for others. Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State are transnational groups. Their aspirations are transnational. Now, the difference between the two is that Al-Qaeda has come to the conclusion that their strategy has to be much more phased. And the big splash 9/11 attacks, US embassies here and there, and so on, that ultimately isn't going to produce for them what they need to produce. And so they've got a very intimate relationship with the Taliban. And that relationship works for them. You know, because they're not planning, you know, they're not in the business of another 9/11 today. I'm not saying that they're long-term out of that business, but for some period of time to come, I think the assumption is that they are. And that's exactly the Islamic State's criticism of Al-Qaeda. You know, they feel that in some ways they're not militant enough, not religious enough, or whatever it may be. It's also their criticism of the Taliban. And so I think you're going to see armed confrontation. Not necessarily civil war. The Islamic State may not be big enough for that. But as depending on how the Taliban as a government evolves and whether it does demonstrate that some things have changed over the last 20 years, those parts of the Taliban that don't like those changes could then cross over to the Islamic State and populate their rank and file. The other thing I just want to say, and then I'll let you take over again, is that the resistance by ethnic groups, the, you know, Tajiks in the Panjshir or Uzbeks, the Taliban may have been initially successful in the Panjshir, but that battle's not over. Now, Ahmed Shah is not his father. That's also true. But nonetheless, so there is potential for domestic conflict.
I just wanted to add to that. It sounds like what you were alluding to earlier was, you know, you could have elements that would defect from the Taliban to the Islamic State if they feel that the Taliban isn't to their religious liking enough, or if there's an ideological fissure that they have within the Taliban, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. And then I guess...
Which really means that the Taliban also has to watch its flanks.
Right. Well, yeah, because that creates a really volatile situation for the Taliban itself. I guess the other important issue to cover, because I feel like a lot of people, at least here stateside, are very woefully ignorant about this. But I think, you know, when we first heard about the airport attack, I remember people saying to me, well, why is the Islamic State attacking the Taliban? And I was like, because they have very different goals. They're not the same. So what is the big difference between Islamic State and the Taliban? Because I feel like even though we shouldn't have to go over that, I feel like some people need to hear what the difference is.
Well, look, I don't think if you ask the Taliban and the Islamic State, the Islamic State would basically, you know, the Islamic State wants a trans-border Islamic State, and it wants it now. I don't think that you would hear the Taliban arguing against it as such. You know, they wouldn't say, no, want nothing to do with that. But, you know, they're focused on Afghanistan. That's their game. and they've never gone beyond it. If they've gone beyond it to any degree, and that's a question of debate, it would have been exclusively in Pakistan. And it would have had to do with the fact that the Afghan Taliban are primarily Pashtuns. And Pashtuns are a significant group on both sides of the border. And so that's one reason why you have a degree of affinity between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban. And Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan has always been convoluted. Pakistan's relationship with the Taliban has been convoluted. And so it's not unimaginable that the Afghan Taliban would have seen virtue in some kind of operation, even if it was one with deniable plausible deniability on the Pakistani side of the border. But that was clearly related to affairs in Afghanistan. It was not related to any global ambition. The Taliban have, and you see that very strongly in the relationship with Al-Qaeda, and also others, had an enormous loyalty to those that have helped them over the last 25, 27 years. And therefore, they're at whatever cost, they weren't going to betray those loyalties. You know, I'm also starting to think that there's a degree of naivete involved. So if you look at the response that the Taliban gave, both to when they finally took control of Kabul airport and found these planes and other equipment damaged in ways that it would be hard to get them operational again. And when Tony Blinken earlier this week in Berlin clearly stated that the Americans were not going to do business as normal with this government, in part because who populated it? You know, people, at least half of the cabinet being on either the US or the UN terrorism lists. The response in both of those cases was, we're disappointed. It wasn't condemnation. And so what I'm reading into that is that they may have no realistic expectations of how the world's going to deal with them. Again, keep in mind that the vast majority of these people haven't left the country. You know, it was a small number that negotiated in Doha, which is where they were exposed to the outside world. By and large, these people haven't left the country. They're not worldly. And so there may be a degree of naivete involved here too.
Since you mentioned the Pashtuns, and I'll start wrapping up after this. I just have one or two more questions. But since you mentioned the Pashtuns, I know a lot of the support for the Taliban in Afghanistan comes from Pashtun segments of the society. Do the Pashtuns have legitimate grievances from the past 20 years of, you know, the Karzai and Ghani governments?
I don't think that they have, I don't think that they have legitimate grievances in Afghanistan, or let's put it this way. They don't have grievances that not others don't have. I think that in Pakistan, that's somewhat different, or in any case, in Pakistan, you had a Pashtun protest movement that ultimately was crushed by the government because they saw it as a threat, you know, because you could get a hookup of Afghan Pashtuns in Pakistan, Pashtuns who want to carve their own state out or integrate Pakistani Pashtun areas into Afghanistan. I think it was more that, you know, the Taliban came out of a group that was in Pakistani religious seminaries. And don't forget that, again, Afghanistan has had 42 years of war, not 20 years of war. And the wars before that were was the U.S.-backed war against the Soviet troops in Afghanistan and the subsequent civil wars. And the Taliban really came out of, people being frustrated with the civil wars, with the warlords. And keep in mind that in the first instance, the Taliban were a service organization, as militant groups often are. And the service that they provided was security and reliability on the roads. So you paid one levy for security, and that was it. You didn't go from checkpoint to checkpoint, managed by whatever groups, and paying multiple bribes to get, to be able to move on. So, I think indeed, what you had was a cohesion in these religious seminaries of people, and they happened to be all Pashtuns, and that was part of their cohesion.
With regards to the lessons of Afghanistan, I know you've written on that as well. What do you think the biggest lesson that needs to be learned from not only just America's incursion into Afghanistan, but just the decades of history we've been seeing with Afghanistan? What is the lesson for the world right now?
Well, I think that... let's go back to the origins of the Afghanistan war. So I was opposed to the war. I thought it was a wrong thing to do. And I changed my opinion 3 weeks into the invasion. And the reason that I changed my opinion was, so the reason I was opposed was that I felt that military action was your last resort, and that the immediate response to 9/11 should be an engagement with the Taliban to try and get them to hand over Osama and so on. What I didn't know at that moment was that the United States directly and indirectly had been negotiating with the Taliban for 3 years. And the Taliban, because of the loyalty and whatever, had refused to hand over bin Laden for the embassy bombings in Africa, the USS Cole, and so on. And so 3 weeks into the invasion, I thought, well, if you've talked for 3 years and you haven't made any headway and this happens, there's nothing more to talk about. So I don't think that the US, as a matter of principle, also from a perspective of domestic politics, had any choice but to strike. The problem was that their goals kept shifting. So you moved from taking out Al-Qaeda to taking out the Taliban. The moment you take out a government, unless you have a clear way of transiting, you've got a caretaker government, you've got a caretaker leader, whatever, you can't get out of the country. You leave behind a mess that may be worse than what you had before. I don't think that the United States has ever thought that through. Also, I lived in the United States for a few years. And one of the things that I realized when I was living there was that Americans, by definition, expected that you wanted to emulate their way of life and that you would want to stay in the United States. You know, it was almost unimaginable that you didn't want that. And I'd gone to the United States because I wanted to live there for several years. I wanted to understand how Washington works. I wanted to build a network in Washington. And that was it. I was not interested in spending the rest of my life in the United States, even though I travel there frequently. So what I'm trying to say with this is the notion was that, you know, you just emulate America. You build an America in Central Asia. It doesn't work that way. And I think so you have a radical swing of the pendulum. The pendulum is swung from we do nation building, you know, Petraeus, Stanley McChrystal, and so on, to we don't do nation building. Fact of the matter is the truth is somewhere in the middle. And I think that's one of the lessons that America has to draw, but it still has to find that middle.
So it sounds like, from your vantage point, things are in a real state of flux now, and we're sort of in a moment of uncertainty, not just for Afghanistan, but also just, I guess, American foreign policy in general.
I think I think that we are in, or that you are, or all of us are, at a moment of inflection. And a moment of, you know, you've had the rise of the Quincy Institute in Washington. And there's some controversy about that. But beyond the fact that the Quincy Institute basically stands for demilitarization, desecuritization of foreign policy, almost more importantly or more telling is who is the Quincy Institute? I mean, this is an institution that is funded by one of the Koch brothers. I think, you know, the other one passed away, who are libertarians, in my perception, far right. At one point, they were supporters and funders of Trump. And who did they get together with? George Soros, you know, who's definitely a liberal in the classical sense of the word, whose concepts of society are very different from those of Koch. And yet this is where they found common ground. So with other words, what you're seeing in the foreign policy debate is a shifting of power, of alliances. I mean, a lot of these arguments that the Quincy Institute puts forward have been longstanding. They're not, you know, they're not necessarily totally new. But the backing that they have today is significant, because that's what tells you is shifting within the power alliances in the foreign policy debate.
This is just a question to end on. Where would you like to see U.S. foreign policy go, and just, the relationship of the Middle East to the rest of the world? I know that's a big question to unpack, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Look, you know, in a sense, part of, let's come back to the original part of this, or the beginning of this discussion, where you had the question of stability versus the risk of change. Change is risky. There's no question about it. We know what stability has cost us. and the problem. We don't know what the instability that comes with change would have cost us. Nor, in a lot of ways, has the West been willing to step up to the plate when it comes to change. So the Biden administration carries human rights high in its agenda. In practical policy, we don't really see that. Tunisia needed help. It needed economic support. And I'm not talking about charity, but helping them strengthen the economy, creating economic opportunity for them, and so on. I mean, this was the one leftover of the 2011 popular Arab revolts. Instead, the West has actually allowed those states that had the financial and other muscle to stage a credible counter revolution, particularly Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They've allowed them to do so. So, yeah, I would like to see a policy that, I don't think you should go out there and change people, states' political structure. But you can say, look, I'm not going to give you an F-35 if you're going to use, or if you're going to use that or to bomb people in Yemen. I think that you've had a total misreading of Iran. And I don't think the Iranians are nice guys. They're not. But there is legitimacy to the way Iran sees the world. There is a logical argument there. And you're not going to get a solution with Iran unless you address that argument. Successive American administrations have been unwilling to do that. At the end of the day, one of the things of the lessons of Afghanistan is that, Iran, that coercion doesn't necessarily work, only works to a certain degree. American foreign policy is built on coercion, whether that's kinetic or not. And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. But in some of the most important cases, it has not. And therefore, I think there may be, that's where you need to have a rethink.
And just with regards to what you mentioned about human rights, a few months ago, we had this Alaska summit with the US and China. And one thing that came up was, whenever US officials would criticize China on something, China would say, well, look at your country, look at what's happening in your backyard with, protests against police violence, or, mentioning our relationship with countries that don't necessarily have a human rights track record that is very sterling, countries like Saudi Arabia, or, maybe Turkey. Do you think, in a way, we've been hypocritical about our own human rights violations that actually undermines us on the international scene with the international community?
Well, let me put it this way. I think, I've long thought that the United States projects or wants the world to believe that there is a moral quality to what it does. There are not that many countries that project that. Maybe some of the Calvinists in the past, Calvinist North Europeans like the Scandinavians or the Dutch, but the United States does. In practice, it's impossible to universally apply those principles. But the United States has never explained what the criteria are in according to which it decides whether it's going to emphasize human rights in a relationship or not. As long as the United States was domestically a functioning democracy, in which you had a degree of cohesion and bipartisanship, even if you had major differences, in which the legitimacy of all four pillars of that democracy, so the executive, the legislative, the judiciary, and the media, was recognized and not challenged, as it was under Trump, for example, the United States was, by and large, under those conditions, the United States, by and large, with all the contradictions that you could point out, was living up to standards that it was advocating. The disarray, the undermining of cohesion that bin Laden contributed to undermined that whole picture. So, you know, whether it's Trump and the and his attacks on the media, whether it's the Black Lives Matter and the whole racism issue in the United States, whether it's what's going on in terms of electoral processes in various US states that essentially are limiting free will. All of that basically undermines the picture of the United States as a functioning model of democracy. Now, having said that, even if you argue that there was genocide against the original Americans, the Indian population, in the last 300 years, there hasn't been genocide in the United States. You do have cultural genocide in Xinjiang. Yes, you can, the Chinese can sort of try and say, well, listen, you're sitting in a glass house, be careful. So are they.
So I want to let you get going. I know we went a little bit over time. I appreciate you staying for a little bit extra. Could you let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work? And I know you have a podcast where you read your articles as well.
Yeah. The best thing to do is to, you can either send me an email and I'll add you to my mailing list, or you can subscribe on substack.com. Just type in either the turbulent world the turbulent world of Middle East soccer, or James M. Dorsey, Dorsey, and you'll find me on Substack and you can subscribe there. It's free subscription. Anybody who does want to contribute financially is welcome, but it is a free subscription and I would welcome you either way.
No one, thank you again, James Dorsey, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with James M. Dorsey. Be sure to check out his blog and podcast, The Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer. Also an excellent book. I would recommend checking all of that out. And, of course, if you appreciate the work I do, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon.com at patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's a $1, $5, $10, and $15 tier. I especially am trying to get listeners to join the $10 and $15 tiers, where you get a producer's credit. We're currently at 23 producer's credit tier supporters. Let's try to make that 25 before the end of the month. In any case, producer's credit shoutouts to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Gunner, Ed, Grass, James, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, TJ, Nick, Amelia, Chase, Chris, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners and supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.